from SSA Acoustics. I'm an associate partner and acoustical consultant at SSA Acoustics. I have a PE in acoustical engineering and have done a lot of things associated with acoustics. Just to sort of give you some background story on how I got into acoustics. When I was 7 years old, my mama, which is my dad's mother, asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I said, point blank, I want to be a singer and I want to design the world's first hover car. And she kind of looked at me. But for me, there's always been this passion for combining sound and science. And so it's, you know, I didn't know where that was going to take me, but it still always contributed to my academic and career path, which has brought me here to be an acoustical consultant. So today I'm going to be talking about ear training, specifically not teaching you how to have perfect pitch or anything like that, musically related, but more to help you kind of tune your instrument that you're naturally born with to understand sounds in your environment so that you can better understand when you hear certain things, what are contributing to those sounds, and specifically what are causing those sounds, and maybe better understand what causes noises in your environment. So the learning objectives we're going to sort of get into, and I'll dive through a lot of just sort of the basic understandings of principles, terms, and conditions for noise, and then also kind of helping you be familiar with the anatomy of the ear, and then my colleagues will start getting into some more of the details associated with equipment and different types of noise operations. So as I said, I'll be talking about, you know, what is sound, how do we hear. We'll talk about ways you can identify different sounds with your ears and kind of using that skill. The idea is that when you sit in and you're listening to a concert, you're able to pick out pieces of that music in terms of an instrument, or maybe you can clearly kind of pick out things. So it's a filter. Your brain has a filter, so helping you kind of understand and modify the use of that filter. And then we'll talk about a couple common misconceptions and issues associated with acoustics, things that are sort of, oh, this is what it is, and maybe it isn't what it is. So hopefully you'll take something from that. So first I'm going to let you hear a couple pairs of audio examples, and these are equivalent in sound level. And just wanted to just sit there, listen to them, kind of see how they make you feel, and then if you want to talk about them later, we can, and I'll just go from there. Again, equivalent in sound level. Two more. And then two more. These are a little bit quieter. So again, equivalent in sound level, but different in perception. So basically, what is sound? Sound is vibration in a medium. So right now, for you to hear me in this room, my voice starts creating pressure waves that is being picked up by this microphone, which is sending an electrical signal through this mixer system to the speakers, and then cones are amplifying that sound and moving those pressure waves to higher amplitude to let you hear them in this space. And so what you're hearing is effectively pressure waves, and the medium that we're most familiar with is air. That's how we tend to perceive sound. It's some variation of airborne pressure waves, but it can travel in any medium, dense materials, water, all those different things. But when we describe sound, we talk about two key terms. We talk about frequency, and we talk about amplitude. Frequency is associated with pitch, or sort of the character of sound. When we talk about it, we also need to be aware of that the inverse relationship to frequency is wavelength. So I'm going to let you hear a quick clip of a frequency sweep, which is starting at low frequency, going to high frequency, but is equal in amplitude throughout. We got a nice reverberation time in this space as well. But so when you're talking about pitch or frequency, you'll refer to things as saying they have a certain frequency, sort of a sound level at a hertz, which is cycles per second. So as an example, a higher frequency sound would be like a young child screaming, which is usually about 3 to 4,000 hertz. So let's just, for this case, say it's 3.5 kilohertz. The wavelength for that would be less than 4 inches. Because of that inverse relationship to the speed of sound. Now, if we have a low-frequency sound, an example being a diesel engine running idle, which is usually between 63 hertz and 80 hertz, that's a wavelength that is 14 feet long. And so that becomes very important when you start dealing with and talking about the mitigation of sound. You need to understand what order of magnitude and how large these wavelengths are. So we're also talking about sound. We deal with amplitude, which is that sound, the level of the sound. Now, the one thing to understand is that what you're hearing actually is always pressure waves, but we deal with a decibel scale. Sound is not inherently a decibel, but humans' perception of sound is applied to a decibel scale. And so to deal with that, there are some other mathematical elements to that. But to give you an oral context of that, I've got a sound clip where we start at a certain level and it increases in 3 decibels every 3 seconds. So, and again, that case, that had equal frequency content in it, but it had different amplitude. So let's dive a little bit deeper into the decibel. What is the decibel? Why do we deal with the decibel? Well, primarily it's because of the really wide range of sound pressure levels that we can hear. The threshold of human hearing, which is 0 dB, and as I mentioned, this is a human scale, so if you have a negative decibel level, it is not a vacuum of sound. Sound is not being removed from the environment. It's just below what you can normally hear. So there are a number of animals that can hear negative decibel levels. But looking at that, 0 decibels is 20 micropascals of pressure change. So what you're hearing is pressure change. Now, the human pain threshold, 140 decibels, is 200 pascals of pressure change. So we have this very significant exponential amount of energy. And so to apply a linear scale to that gets very cumbersome. And so that's why we've applied this log base 10 scale to apply to it and define it and calculate it. But because of that, there are extra challenges associated with doing a log base 10 scale. If you're familiar with your algebra and pre-calculus, hopefully you kind of remember log base 10 evaluations and addition, subtraction, multiplication. But as an example, 30 plus 30 is 33, 30 times 4 is 36, and 100 divided by 5 is 93. So it's one of those things where you're like, wait, what? How am I? Okay. And so understanding it and putting that into context, and that's how we perceive sound. So now I'm going to let you hear audio examples to let you kind of understand better why we use this scale, because humans can only perceive about a 1 to 2 decibel difference. So, and that's equivalent to 5% of the energy. So I'm going to let you hear a 2 decibel difference, and it starts at a level, it drops 2 decibels, then we're going to hear a 6 decibel difference, a 10 decibel difference, and then the last one actually goes up because it's a 20 decibel difference, so it starts a little bit louder but reduces 20 decibels. So here we go. It's subtle, but that was a 2 decibel difference. Here's a 6 decibel difference. And 10. And now 20. So again, it's that 5%. So we're talking about 10% difference, 30% difference, 50% difference, and 100% difference. So you can have a reduction of 100% of the sound energy and still have sound energy. It's not like the cost of something. If it's 100% off, it's now free. In this case, it's not going to be free. So when we talk about sound, the other element, as I mentioned earlier, was frequency. So when we deal with frequency from an engineering perspective, the human frequency range is too vast, and there's also too discrete. Humans can hear tenths and hundredths of hertz, But to deal with 20 to 20,000 hertz in tenths of hertz is just impossible from a calculation standpoint. So what we use is octave bands. So it's effectively like this piano that you see on the screen. And you're taking groups of 12 keys, so each octave, effectively an octave in music, and summing them together to describe the overall character of sound. So when you're listening to something, you're like, oh, well, it has this much sound at this frequency and this much at this. And so you're going through that and evaluating by the types of characters, what we define as low frequency, mid frequency, and high frequency. And when we're doing more detailed analysis, we'll do one-third octave bands, which effectively is groups of four keys being summed together to create a value at each of those locations along a piano keyboard. So I'm going to let you hear each of the center channels for the octave bands. And when we get to the last one, if you can hear it, please raise your hand. So there's 31. It's at the crossover frequency. These speakers don't like it. Who can hear the last one? Good. Actually, I'm pretty impressed. There's some. Usually, after age 30, you can't hear 16,000 hertz and above. So you may have heard about high school kids that have 18,000 hertz ringers, so that they hear them, but their teachers don't. And it is true. And I'll get into explaining why that is in just a moment. So now I'm going to play you an example. It was made by my colleague Mark for us to listen to, and it's a music piece, and it's 10 seconds of a clip of a piece of music that's very frequency rich, and we're going to listen to the first 10 seconds as is, and then we're going to listen to 10 seconds, that same 10 seconds, with octave filters. So we're going to only listen to the 63 hertz octave band of that song, then the 125 hertz, and so on. So there's a lot of information there, and your brain is comprehending all of that in real time for you to enjoy the types of music or even conversations that you usually enjoy. So how do we hear that? What is it about our ear that lets us comprehend all that information? So we have a very interesting system. It's pretty amazing to be, you know, more precise. So you've got the pinna, which is the outside of your ear. But if you look at the size and the overall shape and how thick it is and how heavy it is, it's not good for localization of low-frequency sound. It's intended for localization front to back, but intended specifically for higher frequencies. So like a branch breaking when we probably all at some point lived in the woods. We needed to hear a predator coming towards us. And then you've got your ear canal. An ear canal is an open closed tube. The closed portion is where your eardrum is. All open closed tubes have a natural frequency. For most humans, that's between 2,000 and 4,000 hertz. That also happens to be where infants cry. So anybody who flew here and had an infant crying on their plane probably is like, yeah. And your ear actually is effectively naturally amplifying that frequency. So it is not just your perception, it actually is happening. Then you have your eardrum, and your eardrum is a fibrous membrane that moves with those airborne pressure waves. Now, the interesting thing is the next part of our ear. We have three bones that are a mechanical advantage system that convert airborne pressure waves to waterborne pressure waves. So we're hearing waterborne pressure waves right now. And inside of the, after that conversion, you've got what is called the cochlea. So there's another window in that cochlea. And the cochlea is what you'll see in the lower right-hand side of that picture. And what that is it's a long tube, and in that tube are these little hairs called cilia. And cilia, when energy hits them, it sends impulses to your brain saying, hey, I just received energy, and I'm associated with this frequency, and it was this loud. And I said earlier, 16,000 hertz and above, usually you lose after age 30. Reason being, when the cilia are associated with the wavelengths that are coming in. So the cilia that are all the way at the end are lower frequency. They're the longer wavelengths. The cilia at the window are the cilia associated with higher frequency, 16,000 hertz and above. So an analogy would be if you're a surfer and you go to Maui and you want to catch a big wave. Well, if you didn't get the memo and it's big waves, but you go out an extra mile and a half out, 25-foot swells are coming in, but you didn't get to catch them and get your picture taken and be in the newspaper. Whereas if you had been in that sweet spot, you would have caught that whole wave, but you still experienced that energy. And so if you think about over our lifetimes, we're exposed to and experiencing lots of low-frequency energy, and those cilia effectively have died, or their ability to receive impulses is significantly reduced. So we're going to get into a few more sort of descriptors of noise, just so we're talking with the same thing. We're talking about broadband noise, which is random noise that across broad ranges of frequencies. And so we have a couple different colors of sound that we use. First, I'll let you hear pink noise. And pink noise, the official definition of pink noise, is power spectral density inversely proportional to frequency. So what that really means is that we have an equal amount of sound level at each octave band that we hear. And so that creates that balanced spectrum that you heard. Now you're going to hear white noise, which its official definition is a flat spectral power density. Which means based on what we just talked about earlier with octave bands, we have more frequencies being added together. And so we have a higher amplitude level at higher frequency and lower at lower frequency because each frequency is getting the same amount of energy across for white noise. Now, another descriptor of noise that people are more familiar with, when someone usually says it was this loud, it was this many dB, what they're actually referring to is dBA. And dBA is an A-weighted spectrum. And an A-weighted spectrum is filtered for how humans hear. It's based on audiograms of human hearing and looks at the threshold and then corrects for those levels to give you this is what most people are hearing this sound level at, so that we can use a single value to approximate how people are perceiving it. So this would be that same spectrum of noise now with the A-weighting filter. We've reduced a lot of the low frequency out of that. So, being aware of that when you're talking about an A-weighted level is very important. And also that is designed to be at more of it towards the threshold of human hearing. As you get louder and louder levels, our ear gets flatter and flatter. So for any audiophiles out there, you want flat response speakers. Well, if you put 110 decibels at your ear, it's pretty close to a flat response. I don't recommend it, but you're getting there. So then we also talk about sound with respect to characters of it. So one of the characters we'll talk about is something that's tonal. Something that we can clearly define. And tonal can also be in the context of other noise. But specifically, it is a sound where most or some of that energy is discrete enough that you can pick out a specific kind of character or pitch. And then you have things like fluctuating sound. And this is just changing amplitude generally in the time domain. So it's changing from louder and softer in a time domain in a cycle that you can identify. And then transient sounds, or a car pass, or a plane flyer, or something that has a clear start and a clear end. So when we talk about contributions of noise, I kind of like to use the analogy of musicians. In this case, maybe we can think about the contributions of different elements of a mechanical system as a choir. So we have our main air handling unit fan. So in this case, we're going to have a standard VAV system where we have a main air handling fan, we have a VAV unit, and then we have a diffuser. So think of the main air handling fan as your bass baritones in your choir. And the VAV unit would be kind of the tenors and altos also in that same choir. And if we can keep the sopranos in check, the diffusers would be the sopranos. And so we combine that choir. Now that sounds pretty loud, and this is all as a demonstration, but if we take that same level and then lower it 10 decibels, it's a fairly balanced spectrum that at a low enough level most people would consider acceptable in their living and built environment. And that's really the goal, is to get a choir that when they make music, it sounds pleasant. So then if we take and you think about your whole system, everything in your building, again, using the same music analogy, every piece of equipment is some sort of instrument in an orchestra. And so the engineer, in this case, would be the composer, and the contractor would be the conductor. And obviously the composer thinks everything is perfect. And then if something turns out wrong, well, it's the conductor's fault. But the conductor also has to balance all of those different elements. And, you know, for musicians, that could be ego, that could be lack of training, whatever it could be. But again, all those things have to be in unison to make a beautiful piece of music. But also, there's going to be challenges associated with that and what things stand out. And so making sure that you understand what is your responsibility and how does that contribute. So now I'm going to let you hear different things that tend to be complaints in that orchestra. So we're going to start with the lower frequency sounds described as throbbing, or which is usually associated with turbulence. You know, fan instability. Then we're going to do something more of like the rumble. Still staying within, usually mostly with the fan, and understand too with rumble, that sometimes can be tied to vibration. So that is energy getting into the structure and then elements of that structure radiating that sound energy so that you can hear it. So roar, which again is usually tied to airflow and fans. Or the ever famous hum and buzz. The pump and chiller whine. And the grill or water valve. So you're trying to take all those bits of information out of context and try to be able to walk into those environments and say, well, I can probably trace that type of noise to this type of condition. And that's really what you're trying to do, is diagnose when there are issues, where can I start focusing my energy? One of the biggest challenges, especially with vibration, is people say, oh, well, it's got to be that because I hear it in this room, and vibration can go long distances within a building. So it's not always just that, and being able to sort of discern all the different contributions in your space. So when we talk about design criteria, maybe staying within that same music analogy, we're not comparing you to Mozart, Beethoven, or Bach. The design criteria that are out there established by AHRI are based on 50 years of research as well as interviews, and specifically interviews with the audience. We've gone through and said, what do you expect and what is pleasant? And that's where the noise criteria is defined by, and also DBA. DBA is, is a filtering system, but we've found levels that, based on the room usage, are usually generally considered acceptable. And so now I'm going to let you hear a balanced spectrum. About halfway back in the room, it's about 58 decibels, so it's about 7 decibels louder than what I note here, but the spectrum of sound is what you'll see on that graph. So that's considered a balanced spectrum. So if that's at a quiet enough level, most people would be fine with that, and that's generally kind of analogous to the ocean or something similar to that. Now, with NC specifically, penalizes you if you have things like tones, whereas DBA doesn't always penalize you because it's based on where is that tone. So here is that same character, but now we have a tone at 2.5 kilohertz, or 2,000 hertz, sorry. And I was talking about each decibel being 5%, and that's true for NC. I mean, all the metrics associated with acoustics and HVAC noise are still based in that decibel scale. So in this case, NC is 11-point different, whereas DBA was only 8-point different. So you're talking about, well, one says it's 55% louder, and the other one says it's 40% louder. And so kind of discerning that. And when you have things like that, you'll try to use NC, which will penalize you more, but give you a better idea of what are the objectionalities of that type of sound. Here's two more spectrum and how they align both with respect to NC and DBA. So now I want to get into a few of the misconceptions. So if you notice on the table, I had a baseball and a bouncy ball, and you'd be like, well, how does that tie into acoustics? So absorption versus transmission, understanding the dichotomy of sound. It behaves like a wave, but also it has, in some instances, when you're talking about reflected energy, it's like the bouncy ball. When you talk about the transmission of energy, it's more like the baseball. So I'm going to let you hear all four of these examples, and then I'll explain a little bit further. So we've got a bell. In this case, it's a 70 decibel bell. If you're trying to mitigate that bell, you may go on, and especially if you're doing the trial and error type of noise mitigation, go online and find Sound Stopper. And you buy Sound Stopper, and you make a box around this bell, and you expect to see huge reductions. Oh, well, Sound Stopper is actually fiberglass. You know how it is. You're just trying to sell product. I understand. So thinking about it, now let's actually think about sound more as this baseball. So, okay, if I'm talking about a baseball and I said, hey, I'm going to bring up a pitcher up here, he can throw it 100 miles an hour, and I said, do you want a piece of fiberglass or do you want a piece of plywood? I'm hoping everyone here will take the piece of plywood. So that's, again, you're trying to deal with stopping sound with mass. And so now we take that same bell and we put it inside of a plywood box. And we get a pretty significant reduction. Now, the only thing to note there, it's no longer a 70 decibel bell. It's now a 78 decibel bell. Because inside of that box, each of those hard surfaces is like a mirror, if you were thinking about it from a light perspective. And so if you were inside of that box with the mirror, you'd see there's more than one bell in here now. And so that's effectively what happens, is all of those reflections add to that level. So it's 40% louder inside of that box now, even though it's still only a source level of 70 decibels. So in that case, the marriage of both of those mediums, which is having absorption on a source side but having an adequate mass between the source and the receiver, will give you the reduction that you're looking for. And even then, this fiberglass is not 100% absorptive, so that bell is 72 decibels inside of that box. So now here you can hear all four of them side by side. So getting to sound ratings, which I think applies more to a lot of the projects and pieces of equipment that are probably in this room, when we talk about sound power and sound pressure, what are the differences between those and what do they mean? I heard a great example yesterday for sound power and sound pressure too, as a comparison, and we said, this gentleman said, well, think about it as a lighter. You know, if you light that lighter up, and I said, well, sound power is the heat inside of that flame. Sound pressure is how hot it is at different locations as you move your hand away. So in this case, I'm going to let you hear an example of if we had a 90 decibel source, and that 90 decibel source was rated as a sound rating or LWA of 90 decibels, this is what it would sound like. Now, that's inside of that flame. Now, if we move 5 feet away from that flame, this is what that level would be. Now, on the other hand, if my rating system wasn't based on sound power, but instead was based on a reference distance, another sound was sound pressure versus sound pressure, so I said, oh, well, it's 90 decibels, but it's 90 decibels at 3 feet. So again, my hand's already 3 feet from the flame, and it's already 90. So you guys think, well, if it's 90 there and the candles, ooh, that's probably pretty hot. So what we're saying here is they're not comparative. And so it, as an example, the same 90 decibel source, but now referenced at 3 feet. Now measured at 5 feet. In basic hemispherical radiation, you lose 6 decibels per doubling of distance. So in this case, we didn't even lose 6 decibels because we didn't effectively double that distance. And so this is the important part with respect to pressure and power, and that's why power tends to be so important, and that we compare apples to apples, because even though they are both dBA, a pressure level is not equal to or comparative to a power level. We cannot easily compare those without understanding measurement environments and overall conditions. And so it's very important that the things be published as a sound power. And now just a few more misconceptions, and then we'll be on to the next presentation. So specifically noise barriers, making sure you understand that it's not as based on how thick or how heavy those barriers are, but more to do with the geometry. So if you have a chiller at the bottom of a valley and you've got a house on the hill, and if you build a 10-foot wall, but it's only 10 feet away from that chiller, you may not get much performance out of that barrier. Because, again, it's based on the geometry, and that geometry is dominated by the source path length difference. So from the source to the receiver is one distance. Now if I take that path from the source to the top of the barrier and then to the receiver, that difference in distance has to be significant to get the performances that we're looking at. But if we take that same 10-foot wall and put it at the top of the hill, because we've taken advantage of the geometry. Another one is vegetation as a noise barrier. Trees do not work. They're great for screening, but visually only. So if you've got, again, that chiller, and effectively we put up 200 feet thick of vegetation. The calculations for this would be usually about less than 4 decibels of reduction for 200 feet thick of vegetation. And again, that has to be there year-round. So you better be planting a lot of deciduous trees. And it's got to be from floor to canopy. So understanding you can hide a regular noise barrier in the context of this, but it's not going to solve it alone. And then when we talk about masking, I think this is the greatest challenge that we all have in this room, is right now the common practice for noise masking is to say, well, your HVAC system better be really quiet. Oh, it's too quiet. I'm going to go spend more money and add noise back into this environment. And so you said, well, I spent $10,000 on mitigation, and you're going to spend $10,000 on adding noise back in. How about we negate all that and we just balance it the first time? And that's really the challenge I see we all have right now. So specifically, noise mitigation is adding noise ideally that is pleasant and is not going to add to the annoyance factor of an environment, but effectively is going to hide speech conversations. So in this case, we've got an audio clip from a movie.
There's nothing more toxic or deadly than a human child. A single touch could kill you.
So now we'll add masking.
There's nothing more toxic or deadly than a human child. A single touch could kill you.
Now that's that balanced spectrum we had earlier for HVAC, but at a little bit louder level. And you can see that low frequency, because of what we consider generally acceptable for HVAC, has a little bit more low frequency and less high frequency, is not doing an effective job of masking that speech. Or if we've got an environment where we add the masking back in.
There's nothing more toxic or deadly than a human child. A single touch will kill you.
Now I've exaggerated these clips, but again, you're saying, well, if someone's talking loudly, I've got to play noise that's loud enough that you can't effectively hear what they're saying. Or again, one of the challenges with masking is making sure that it matches the amplitude or the frequency that you have of your sources. The snoring is lower in frequency than most of the masking systems, so it's not going to provide adequate masking. And so always understanding and balancing that to fit your needs. And one more example.
More toxic more deadly than a human child. A single punch could kill you.
And so that last one is if we were to take that HVAC system and try to get it up to an effective level to provide masking. And, you know, understanding and balancing masking is the most important part and is the most challenging part. But I think as a community, it's somewhere where that we can actually come together. These masking systems are sold as off-the-shelf solutions for noise after a mechanical system has gotten too quiet for these environments. And so there's definitely opportunities there. And just wanted to point out, if you didn't already look at the slide where it's 35 dBA for a patient room in ASHRAE, and the FGI, which is an architectural standard, allows masking to be 13 decibels louder than that. So there's room for us to find common ground.